Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Just like last week, we will attempt to make this episode shorter than the film, so we will only be talking about Roman's Chariot's Betrayal and Vengeance for 3 hours. It's been her on Zach on Film.
Oh, my God.
Well, okay, so the movie is what?
Three hours and 42 minutes.
Yeah, something like that. But you can take out 20 minutes of that, because the first 15 is your...
The first 7 is a lot of fanfare.
Right. Well, and then you've got your
credits,
intermission.
And then you get credits. And you get
intermission. How long is the intermission? Is the intermission like 5 minutes?
It's like 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's like 5.
Yeah. Or at least the one that's in the iTunes version that we watched.
Yeah.
Right.
I just didn't understand this. So right. I think the overture and the credits were about 10 minutes.
Yes, the overture was a good 6 minutes.
Yeah. So then you get there's a reel, right?
Probably.
Right. Why don't they just make the intermission a full 10 minute reel and just like, okay.
Because done. They're giving you the full Ben-Hur experience that people had.
I mean, you can just add 5 minutes to it. I mean, you're already out.
Where he means originally. Why didn't they make
girlfriend
they just project
and
it.
You exit with a 4-year-old?
Yeah, I don't know.
Baby.
That's a good question, because I guess people know that they need to get to the bathroom and get back, or that maybe many people don't have to use the bathroom.
Just get up and
get
stretch.
Concessions. Get up and stretch really quick. You don't, because the overture is welcome to our production.
Sure.
And so people are going to be coming in still 10
minutes
before the movie.
Is that how
they
did it? It was like the overture was the trailers?
No, not the trailers, because I'm sure...
Was there still trailers?
I don't know.
The overture is a very slow darkening of the house lights.
Okay.
You got to remember, too, that this movie, and we're talking about Ben-Hur, this movie came out at a time when the studios were like totally screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Left and right.
Yeah, they said MGM was like out of money.
Yeah,
and they made this like last ditch effort.
I mean, the lion doesn't even roar in this.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Frozen lion.
Well, no, the reason why the lion doesn't roar is because they thought it would be too abrupt, right up next to the birth of Jesus.
Interesting. Well,
yeah,
but he's the lion of Judea.
Yes, but he is a calm lion.
So
he is a lion unruffled.
So this was, I think, maybe the only time. Well, there have been a couple of others where there's a Tom and Jerry cartoon where they turn Tom into the lion.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time that you never see the lion roar in the MGM logo.
All of the Chuck Jones cartoons had Tom as the lion.
But the thing was, the studio system had collapsed, so they don't even have their own distribution system there. That screwed them over. Then you've got television.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got, I don't know what else is going on. The pool hall.
The greasers.
The latest doodad.
The latest doodad.
The jelly
what do we had? Korean War going on at this time?
Or not in Korean, 59.
Not
no.
in 59.
It'd have been over for a couple of years.
So you got a lot of stuff hurting the studio system right now. And the only way they can bring people in is let's make it a spectacle. Let's make it bigger and better than anything you can find on television. So that's why we've got a 70mm print, super wide.
Mm-hmm.
What are we shooting in Cinema 65 or whatever it is for this movie? Mm-hmm. And that's why you have this overture welcoming people into the theater. And they probably didn't show trailers before this movie.
I don't know. In 1959, would they still have been doing like the newsreel and the cartoon?
No. But what I'm saying is they probably didn't do that for this movie because it was such a spectacle. When they did that again, and we'll bring this back up again, I'm pretty sure, when, if I remember correctly, when Phantom Menace came out, there was a stipulation that they could only have like 5 minutes of something ahead of the movie, and that was it. Or maybe it was they couldn't even show any trailers. They had to
get
right into the movie, and Lucas demanded that.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and look that up. But there have been a number of movies where we have a... In fact, we've watched a couple of them. The other long movie that we watched...
No,
the other one.
Brother of a Nation.
No.
Bridge of the River Kwai.
Lawrence of Arabia. That's it did have the...
It's a longer
it
one.
Had a, it had
an overture and an intermission.
Intermission.
Heck, it's a Mad Men.
Yes, it also did, too.
Had, yeah.
What's interesting, though, is where the intermission took place in this movie. It's like, and there's only an hour left. Why don't you guys get up and stretch for, you know, for 5 minutes? You've already been sitting here for 2 hours. At least in like in JFK, that was the movie that I've been in a theater where they actually gave you the intermission. It came in a part where here's everything leading up to the court case. Let's take your intermission, come back. And now the second half of the movie is the court case,
right,
which I thought was nice.
Makes sense.
One, though, it was like the intermission hit and I was like, wait a minute, there's only like 45 minutes to an hour left in this movie. Why are we taking
the intermission? The intermission hit at like 2 hours and 30 minutes because
literally an hour left in the movie when the intermission hits. That's why I was like, well, there's probably 10 minutes of credits. So there's less than an hour left, but whatever. So, Zach, tell us the story of Judah Ben-Hur.
It's so long.
It's a story of the Christ. Did you know that? It's a story about Jesus.
Well, Jesus is tangentially involved in the background.
Oh, no. This movie is... And this is funny because Rodrigo came over earlier today. And I was like, Rodrigo, you know what this movie is the equivalent to, right? And then Zach walked in 10 minutes later, and what'd you say this movie was, Zach?
Oh, I said this is Forrest Gump of the Jesus story.
Yep. Forrest Gump is the Bible.
And that's exactly Python's Life of Brian, done earlier.
Yeah, we had a discussion about that, I think, before we called you. That's a little bit different in that, in the Forrest Gump analogy, Ben-Hur is bumping into Pontius Pilate, he's bumping into Jesus, he's bumping into one of the wise men, and he's just, you know, bumping into all these people that you know from reading the Bible, whereas Life of Brian is like, oh, we're going to go follow Jesus. Oh, yeah, well, we're just going to go follow Brian, and Brian's like, oh, don't follow me.
Life of Brian is like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in the Bible.
Yeah. And we also mentioned that before. And what did you call it, Rodrigo?
What did I call it? Pontius Pilate and Guildenstern are dead.
Yeah.
So, I guess the story of Ben-Hur, there's this prince of Judea. He's friends with this buddy guy who's coming back to rule over that province. They get in a little hissy fit fight. He sends them away to work in the gallows of a Roman ship where he will most likely die. Newsflash, he doesn't die because the movie would have been a lot shorter if he had. He's rowing the boat. A new general comes on the boat. They like bond over because he's been there for so long and he rows like a bad mother. And he ends up saving the guy and becomes like his son in Rome. And they go to Rome and they're pretty cool. Together, but something is stuck back in Ben-Hur's mind. He has to go save his mom and his sister because little prissy pants back in Judea also put them in prison.
Masala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, masala.
Same thing.
So
I love his chicken.
He takes the quest back to Judea, finds some old friends, meets a guy with a lot of cool horses on the way there. Mm-hmm. He ends up going to race them in the big race in Jerusalem against Masala because he has been told that his mom and sister are dead, and now he must avenge them because there's no rules inside the arena. And when you leave the arena, you can do whatever you want. A Judea prince can kill a Roman officer. No one's really going to bat an eye. And,
8 men and 32 horses will enter. 1 man and 4 horses.
Yes. And so big spectacle we'll get to of a chariot race takes place. What's the guy's name?
Masala.
I just said it. Masala. Masala gets trampled by a bunch of horses. Before he dies, he's like, yo, Ben-Hur, guess what? Race ain't over yet. Your mom and sister, they're lepers.
No!
Yeah.
You know what they say about lepers, Zach?
They can't not even gonna make a joke. Anyways, Ben-Hur is troubled, and then his mom and sister have leprosy, and they don't want him to see him. But then, Jesus comes to town and, then we get real Forrest Gumpy with the Jesus story in Jerusalem.
I know that
he,
man.
He gets tried, crucified. They're in the background. Rain, leprosy's gone. In the movie.
End.
In the movie.
Charlton Heston falls on his knees and looks at the Statue of Liberty. You bastards!
Yeah, so Jesus is a badass in this movie at one point.
Isn't he, though?
Because when Masala, it's this like little minor thing. It was an accident that hit the new governor. This tile fell off the roof and hit the governor. Mm-hmm. And Masala uses this as a chance to get rid of Ben-Hur, who he was once friends with, but basically said, I need you to keep the Jews calm so that they can just obey Roman law. And Judah Ben-Hur is like, screw that. I can talk to him, but I'm not going to, you know, tell him what to do. And so he gets sent off into the galley, like you said. But along the way, he has to go on this march across the desert. And they stop off at one place for a rest. And the town mm-hmm. folk come out and they're giving water to all the prisoners. And somebody comes out to give water to Ben-Hur. And the guard goes, no water for him. And then this man in this robe and long hair, red
walks
hair,
up,
walks up. Yeah. Gives Ben-Hur the water, and Ben-Hur sees his face and is just taken in by it. And then the Roman guards coming up and said, hey, no water for him. I told you this. And they do this shot where like Jesus stands like, up and he's like 8 foot tall. And the Roman guards like, okay. Yeah,
it's like a total rock moment. He like raises his eyebrows and the guy backs down.
Well, but that's the other thing too in this movie is we never see Jesus's face.
Right. No.
Jesus flowing hair.
But Jesus just stands there and faces him down. It's beautiful.
I guess
it's pretty crazy that moment when you're like, oh my God, that's Jesus. And look how tall he is.
I guess forgot to mention, so after the overture, the first other than the credits, and then like the first 10 minutes is actually like the birth story of Christ.
Yep.
Birth of Jesus.
Right. Forgot to throw that in there because
that becomes important later.
Yeah, it becomes important because I guess maybe tangentially, like Life of Brian. Methuselah, whatever the old guy with the white hairs.
Balthazar.
Balthazar. Mistakes Ben-Hur for Jesus because they're like born at the same time and see him at the well and stuff.
Like 2 blocks apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right down the manger aisle.
So why then? Let me ask you this. This is a pretty good story of just a guy. Right? I mean, we've seen that movie called Gladiator.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Why then the story of the Christ? Why is this called Ben-Hur, the story of the Christ?
Because the book was.
Yeah, I don't. it's hard to figure it out. It's really a reason that exists outside of the movie. It almost has to, right?
Yeah.
Because this isn't a story of the Christ,
right?
It is actually the story of Judah Ben, who is like, "What's up, guys?" Mm-hmm. And then he gets sent to the galleys, and then makes his way back as a super cool prince of Rome, or you know,
pretty much,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, it's like it happens concurrently with the Passion,
mm-hmm.
right?
But there's no reason why it should be subtitled that, other than something like either a marketing thing or because they were like, oh, this movie is disrespectful or something like that. And they're like, we need more Jesus in this.
Was the film actually subtitled?
Well, because I know the book was. It says at the beginning when you're watching the beginning of the movie, it says the story of the Christ.
Oh yeah. True.
I think in some ways it's kind of a safety net because you can tell, you know, that the greatest story ever told,
which came out
chunks
in 65,
of this
though.
Story, yeah, in 1959 in America. Big chunks of this story are pretty much known to most, if not all, your viewing public. Mm-hmm. But you are also telling this, you know, this tale of heroism and fighty-fighty and one strong man against an evil empire. And the way they handle Jesus in here, the fact that they won't put Jesus center stage is it feels kind of partly like an issue of respect and partly like that's not the story they're telling. They're telling a story that has all that in it. And, you know, this man's life is affected by the existence of Jesus.
Right.
And you know, the bits and pieces.
And I think that's the thing that they're trying to hammer home is here's somebody that doesn't want to be, that only wants to be identified with this, but by the end, he has come to Christ.
Right.
Or he has found Jesus.
Literally. Like, oh, look, yeah. Literally, he is.
He's right up there.
That guy helped me once. He gave me some water. I will do the same and give him water again, back.
So, you know, from a story standpoint, it's like, it's really off-putting.
Yeah.
Like, to an audience that is very familiar and very involved with the story of Jesus Christ, they must have been like, I don't know. It's hard to figure out what you could compare it to. But yeah, it's like, oh, this is a part where Jesus does this. This is a part where Jesus does that. And they're like, oh, they're all like very like stunned by Jesus. That's great. But if you're not, or if you don't care or anything else, it's like, it feels really weird and forced. There's this other character whose face you never see that just like does these really impactful things to the characters just by them looking at him. Right. And it's never explained why.
Yeah.
No one ever saw us. Oh, no one ever says, oh, by the way, that's the Son of God. I mean, they do kind of they mention it.
They keep mentioning that, oh, there's this guy that claims to be the one true God. And of course, they kind of compare Ben-Hur to that when, you know, they're always making fun of him of, oh, you Jews, you are only with the one God.
Right,
when he wins the chariot race and Pontius Pilate is sitting there going, oh, today we honor you as the one God or whatever that they're going on. So they are making these parallels and Balthazar, whatever his name is looking for Jesus. The Sheik who has the horses and basically
Sheik
the backer of Ben-Hur.
Right.
Ben-Hur.
Sheik Blackface.
He knows,
He
knows that there's this guy Jesus running around doing these things, but there's never any talk of miracles.
Right.
There's talk of you need to listen to this guy. But never do they mention any miracles. They never mention that he's caused trouble or that he's denouncing Rome or doing, you know, tearing up the marketplace or anything like that.
So, like, Jesus is actually not a big part of the story, which makes the ending feel like such a giant cop out to me.
Yeah.
Well, when you look at this, though, I mean, Ben-Hur is a Hebrew patronym. This is a Jewish character who is in a Jewish faith. And he spends this whole movie going through this stuff. And at the end, this Jewish guy learns, you know, in the story terms, the truth of what's going on with, you know, Jesus and the crucifixion and the resurrection and all the happy stuff. You know, on some level, it could be seen as maybe this Jewish person who is in the story's terms misguided being brought around to the quote unquote truth.
Oh, absolutely.
That's exactly what it is. And there were several critics.
You know, in 1959.
Well, you're right.
You know.
But, you know, there were several critics that came out and said that, yeah, we get what you're saying. You don't have to beat us over the head with it. Another critic was like, this is being stuck watching a 4-hour long train and you can't do anything about it. And then John Pym, who wrote for Time Out, he's a British film critic, called this a 4-hour Sunday school lesson, which he was kind of dismissive of the movie. So, without a doubt, this is I truly believe that this is a religious film, very much like the Ten Commandments or the greatest story ever told and those kind of things. I don't know if we were talking earlier or whatever, but Matthew and I were talking about how we feel pretty sure that we watched this during a week-long Easter special when we
were
kids.
Over the course of like 9 days.
Where you would watch the greatest story ever told, Ben-Hur, and then wrap it up with the Ten Commandments. I think that's pretty much the way they did it for Easter.
Yeah. Interesting. So like they kind of did it in like reverse chronological order.
I think they did it from popularity because Ten Commandments was like the big one to watch. And then I think it was early in the week you watched The Greatest Story I Ever Told, or at least, you know, that's what they aired. And I think it was one channel that was doing all of it, like ABC or something was just
only three channels.
All week long. Here's religious programming for you, so.
Right. And then CBS had like the Charlie Brown Christmas or something.
And I think the problem is you can't run Ben-Hur and Ten Commandments back to back.
No, because it just blends together.
Yeah, it's kind of an endless thing. But I remember when I was 16 and I sat down to watch this movie and literally it just ended.
So, Zach, you said that this movie was like MGM's last ditch effort.
Well, I remember reading, like, they put a bunch of money into it because the budget was like $15 million.
They pumped a bunch of money in it because they were like
they had
close
to make a lake. They had to build a lake in Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see it. You can see the production value
they
in this.
Like it's 100.
Huge. The sets are huge.
100, yes. Like, seamstress people just making costumes. Mm-hmm. 200 artists and sculptors to make all of the art and everything we see in Rome and then at the chariot race. Yeah. They used something like 10,000 extras.
Yeah, something like
to
that.
Make this movie.
Did they build that whole set, or was there a matte painting involved?
No, there's times where you can see that there is a matte painting, but a lot of times it's, you know, they have to have 10,000 people milling around and cheering in the stands.
And they said
that's amazing.
They filmed a lot of this in like Italy.
Yeah, they had to because that's what the director was like. Yeah. Hey, if you want me to direct, we got to do it in Rome.
And there was apparently it was like hard economic times in the country, and they needed all these extras. So, like 7,500 people shows when they're doing the chariot race showed up to be extras in this, but they only needed like 2,000 or 3,000 or something for this scene. And so, like half the people that showed up to try to get money to sit and watch this movie get filmed got turned away, and they started rioting. The police had to get called in, and they were shutting them out from the Coliseum or whatever.
So just also in kind of comparison, we're talking about how over the top this was in production. The ships in the big scene, like I said, they literally made a lake, to do this in. They had 40 ships. Most of them were, and so this is miniature. Now keep this in mind, miniature. 175 feet long the miniature.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's amazing. I mean, when you think about this, we're almost going to go broke. MGM is running low on funds. What should we do? Let's mount the most extensive production ever done and build Rome. And I mean, sure, it pays off, but think about the cojones that took.
One could make the comparison of Nero and, you know, they're playing while the city burned.
I don't think it's that.
It was. I think this was a last-ditch effort.
You think this was them being like? You think this was them saying, "Well, we're going under. We might as well get as in debt as possible before that happens."
I think this is them saying, "The studio is burning. Let's just go crazy all out and see what we can do to turn this around."
I think it's them being like, we have a gallon of gas left. Let's just blow it up and see how far that gets us.
Right. And, you know, it paid off. They made like 6 times their budget.
Yeah, it was the highest.
And this is 1959 dollars, where a dollar was actually worth 87 cents.
Well, and it was at that time, second highest grossing film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it falls today, but I mean, if it's still right behind Gone with the Wind,
it's not
in adjusted dollars.
It's not in adjusted. I looked at the top 10 for adjusted today. It's not.
Is it in the top 10?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
So,
but
go ahead.
Well, I was going to turn into the chariot race and just talking about, because the shooting for this movie was like 8 months.
Yes.
That's how long they took to film this. The chariot race scene was 3 with like 5 weeks of filming, and they're filming, they said, 12 to 14 hours a day,
right?
6 days a week,
right?
All in this chariot thing. People had to learn. Charlton Heston learned how to drive one of those 4-horse chariot things, and someone else, and they had a bunch of stunt people, and they had like 1,000 horses. The shooting ratio for the chariot scene is 234 to 1.
Wow. That's
they ended amazing. Up, I mean, there's over 1 million feet of film in this movie of raw footage shot.
And most of it is on screen. Ben-Hur apparently is number 13 adjusted, 795 million adjusted gross. Wow.
So some other crazy facts about this chariot scene. Because they're shooting in 70 millimeter, they have to maintain a certain distance away just to get minimum focus, which is 50 feet. They have to stay 50 feet away from everything at any time to make sure that it's in focus. So they're running around this stadium with these horses in the arena, and they had some Italian car that was trying to stay in front of the horses. Even at flat out speed, the horses were catching up to the car. They
like
brought
a,
in
a Topolino.
I don't know what it was. They brought in an American car. The horses were still faster than the American car. And so that's why a lot of the close-up stuff that we see are very short pieces of the riders, because it's like we can't
go out of focus.
Yeah, we can't get any closer in this.
That's cool.
They brought in two other directors to shoot like a lot of the wide stuff and crowd reactions. What they said is apparently like a shot for shot remake of the 24 or 34 whenever they first made this film. Like the crowd reactions and stuff is all like the same.
Right.
So they shot all of that and then they edited that all together and then showed the director and everyone else where to put in all of the close-ups, which is interesting.
Wow.
Now then, did you compare this? Did you go frame by frame and compare this to the pod race scene, which is exactly
this is? No, but yeah, we talked about that last week after we finished talking about the kid. But yeah, this is totally like I haven't watched Phantom Menace since it came out in 3D in theaters. But if you know that going into it, there's so many even just like set things or just the way they show different elements that's like, oh my God, this is still like the lap markers. I don't know why them pointing on the fish just reminded me of those weird glyph things to show the different things. And then you have Pontius Pilate with Jabba like sitting up there with all of his
Pontius goonies.
But even the fight with Anakin and Sebulba where their two pod things interlock
together.
I mean,
and the two-headed announcer in Rome.
Well, they did have those two guys with flags up at the top doing their thing.
You know what I found fascinating about this, and this is something that I picked up, I think, when we saw this in college. You know the point where Ben-Hur's chariot actually ramps up over the... And the guy flies over the thing? That's the stuntman nearly dying, flying over the front of the thing.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't properly braced and then climbing back in.
Yep.
And everybody thought this man was dead. And apparently this sequence was so great that they had to use it in the film.
Right.
I'm like, dude, the man nearly killed himself. Of course we're going to put it in the movie.
Oh yeah.
Now when we talk about Star Wars and Ben-Hur and the chariot race in particular, which takes about 30 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
In both movies.
Yeah.
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 I don't know how much of an influence Ben-Hur had on George Lucas, but we know that Star Wars by itself is an homage to, and Indiana Jones is an homage to everything that George Lucas loved and Steven Spielberg loved as kids when they were growing up. So I would imagine at 59, Lucas has to be just about ready to go into college or just wrapping up college at some point in the late 50s. This movie had to have some kind of influence on him to say, when he's doing this bit, I'm going to do an homage of Ben-Hur.
Anakin is driven by the same thing that Ben-Hur is, the loss of his mother or the seeming loss of his mother.
Right.
You know, you get through the whole thing. Anakin, of course, is born the chosen one. Ben-Hur is born one of the chosen people. I mean, what's he, 15, 16?
Later on, Anakin comes back and slaughters everyone that ever bothered his mom.
Yep.
That's right. I mean, I think there are a lot of parallels there. And of course, you have Jar Jar and you have the extensive use of brown face here. I mean, there's the racist aspect that has to carry over.
Yeah, thank goodness they were able to find a Middle Eastern person with blonde hair and blue eyes to play Ben-Hur.
Yeah, it's amazing how they pulled that off.
Yeah. Well, that's the amazing thing is like,
you know, Paul Newman was going to be Ben-Hur at one point. I think they wanted Marlon Brando at one point to be Ben-Hur.
Well, we've got a movie coming out soon, Exodus Gods and Kings.
No.
Christian Bale is Moses in it.
We also had the Moses movie, Noah that just came out.
Yep.
It's
like you look at it and it's like the, you know, DreamWorks, like the Prince of Egypt is like the only movie that I've ever seen that had like accurate skin tones.
Yeah.
But even then, they're all voiced by white people.
Yeah.
But think about this, you know, the real missed opportunity is Leslie Nielsen not playing the part of Missala.
Yeah.
Because he said, Leslie Nielsen actually read for that role and did a screen test. Ooh. And can you imagine how awesome that would be with his little fart machine? That would be cool. I think they said, who was the, there was somebody who was wanted to be, or they
Kirk
wanted
Douglas
to be
Ben-Hur. Wanted to be. Kirk Douglas yes. was vying for, was really wanting to be it. But then they went with,
Charlton Heston.
Yeah, Charlton Heston.
Who's really actually kind of the same guy.
Paul Newman said he didn't want to do it because he didn't have the legs to be wearing a skirt.
A skirt.
Plus, you know, he was busy drinking for 6 years.
Burt Lancaster turned it down because he thought it was belittling Christianity.
Makes really? Sense.
Yeah.
Wow. I would say this movie,
like, and that makes sense.
Oh, no, because
like,
every time you talk about, you know, one God, everybody's making fun of it.
Yeah, this had to be like a prevailing idea at the time because the movie actually, again, and that's why a lot of the scenes with Jesus or that revolve around Jesus feel so disingenuous. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. Here's this story that they want to tell. A moment in time in which not just Christianity, but all Abrahamic religions, you know, basically mm-hmm. Judaism, because Christianity didn't exist yet, were like crap. Nobody wanted them. Right. Nobody liked them. Nobody wanted to have anything with them. They were all idiots. Jesus comes around. He's an idiot. He's terrible. And that's the story that it's trying to tell. And in a lot of ways, it's satisfying for lots of reasons. It's satisfying because Christians watched this movie and they were like, oh, how little did they know that he's the one true God, which is reasonable. Right. It's mm-hmm. your religion. That's fine. Yeah. And people who aren't Christians are like, oh, yeah, eventually Christianity would become this huge world power and very important, right? And everything about it is fine, but there's also this, like, thin, mucusy film on top of, like, them just being, like, so scared that Christians were going to see this and say, wait a minute, how come all these Romans don't automatically love Jesus? How come everybody doesn't automatically love Jesus in this movie?
I think in the time period, and, you know, we have a lot more openness about religion today. Mm. But Matthew made a joke about Jewish people in the 1950s. You know, if you tried to talk about anything other than Christianity,
sure,
then you were going to hell, right?
Sure.
So in this case, I think it's fine to look at it and say, oh, yeah, look at those Romans. They're the ones that killed Jesus. Oh, yeah, look at the Jews. Yeah, they're the ones that killed Jesus. And it's just like, well, there's no other way to portray this movie except in the way that they did it if they're going to put Jesus in the film.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I would argue that you could cut out everything having to do with Jesus and it would still be a solid film.
Oh, it absolutely would be, mm-hmm. especially the part where they find his mother and sister in the gulag and they just leave him there because you don't see them taking them out.
Right.
Just cut out everything that happens after that. Ben-Hur gets super mad, kills Masala. Masala says, the race is not over. Credits.
Yeah.
Like, just make this like a super sad film about this guy who got taken away from his house, tries to get his life back, and it just doesn't work. He's got nothing.
Yeah.
He gets in a fight with his super attractive girlfriend about it. And then, like, she's like, I don't know who you are anymore. He wanders off into
the
desert.
Thing. He was going to wander off into the desert.
Yeah.
Let him wander off into the desert.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It would have been such a strong statement. Like, that kind of, like, you know, like, a conquering state does this to the people it conquers.
Right.
I mean, what a huge statement that would have been.
And to me, I think Ben-Hur could have got to the pacifist mindset without the Jesus in there. I think his character development in the way like he shaped in the beginning of the film, seeing his once friend deformed and bloodied essentially at his hang, I think his character arc could have pushed him in that pacifist world just from seeing that.
And it would have because, for example, it would have been a lot stronger if Esther had convinced him to drop everything. She's like, I don't know who you are anymore. You have nothing left except for me. You're going to lose me if you continue your crusade. And he goes like, oh my God, you're right.
Yeah.
If you
and then they get together. And that would be like that quote-unquote happy ending.
Yeah.
But going back to the political side of whoever was mentioning the politics, Masala left. He grew up in Judea.
Right.
Went to Rome, came back, changed.
Sure.
What happens to Ben-Hur?
Yep, absolutely.
He is forced out of Judea. He goes to Rome and becomes a Roman citizen.
Yeah.
They say, you are a Roman citizen. Not only that, this general, I want to adopt you as my son.
That's right.
You have all the power that I have. You are a Roman.
A cool ring.
Yeah, a cool ring.
A Roman name.
Yeah.
Again, such like, again, so lost on people.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that this is what happened to the Native Americans in the United States.
Or just any conquering.
Just any conquered people. Mm-hmm. It's like, you come over here, you're a slave. It's like, oh, you're good. You're actually one of the good ones. Here's a Roman name. As opposed to a Christian name.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, here's like this power we now bring into our own. But Ben-Hur is still like a like sea urchin shaped peg in a round, you know, hole. And like he doesn't fit in and he just can't do it. It's like it would have been such a magnificent thing like for this movie to just play on that subtext. And in the end, it just kind of drops it over to basically clock in with the same ending as The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because to me, watching it, because if anyone's ever gone up a church or been to a church around Easter or anything, like you see, like we talk about Forrest Gump.
In the Catholic Church, you actually have to perform.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You have to perform the catechisms and everything.
You have to do the trial of
the stations.
Jesus, yeah. Well, no, you actually, they perform this thing where you are the rabble of the town, and the priest is Pontius Pilate, essentially. He's like, do you want me to save Jesus, or do you want me to save, what's the other guy?
Barabbas.
Which I was disappointed we didn't actually see Barabbas. In the way this movie was shaping, I was like, where is Barabbas? Like, there's no reason Barabbas shouldn't have been in this.
Right.
Like, Barabbas
should have been like his friend.
Yes. Yeah. Because I was just watching this. I'm like, they're in Rome. I'm like, Pontius Pilate. Okay, that's a good one. And then I just almost lost my mind when they said they had leprosy. I was like, are you kidding me? It's like, okay, I know how it's going to end. Whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean...
I saw that coming from my level. Yeah. I was like, oh, come on. Especially when the movie continued to not end.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, oh, no.
The movie continued to not end for like an hour.
So wait, in church you actually get to go crucify him, crucify him.
You're reading this, and it's like, who do you want, Barabbas or Jesus? Barabbas, free him. And what should we do with Jesus? Crucify him. And you do that in the church so you can kind of see how this is. It's really weird and always disturbed me. And that's probably why I don't go to church anymore and why I don't have.
Wow.
Maybe I need to be stumbling in the desert thirsty and...
Maybe.
I have my faith again.
No, you probably don't. I was disturbed.
Haired man.
I was disturbed when the Sheik put the Star of David on him 1,200 years before it became a thing. But
Well, and you look at that, and you look at that Sheik, and that Sheik is like a 1950s perception of a modern Arabic person. Like,
that guy is Welsh, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, certainly.
Oh, it wasn't played by John Rhys-Davies?
but a similar situation, right?
Yeah,
I did like that. They're like, these horses are named for the stars, and then they say each horse is named like 10 times. Oh, Rigel. Oh, Aldebaran. Oh, Rigel.
Wait.
Oh,
hold on. I had a question about that scene. One, it seemed like some pretty good improv because those horses were just acting up. And he was just playing with it. That was nice.
That was well done.
But was there an implication of bestiality in that scene?
When he said that he was going to go see his darlings and his wives, and then they brought in the horses.
See which one he was going to embrace first.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that there is, but I don't think it was purposeful. I can very much read it in there.
So interestingly, though, if you're going into that area, the guy who was playing Marsala was specifically told, you need to act as though you are a homosexual lover spurned. When Ben-Hur says he doesn't want to have anything to do with you, he was told to act that way. They didn't tell Charlton Heston that that's how he was approaching the role.
Uh-huh.
And so there's this another weird ambiguity going on between those two.
But that's great. That's absolutely 100%. Like when they get started, like when those two first meet, I was like, dude, this is so gay. And just in the best possible way, right? Here's two people who aren't allowed to be gay, but are so gay for each other. And then like politics get in the way. It's Romeo and Juliet. It really is. And the movie was not disappointing in that sense anyway, because even though it's like never said out loud or consummated in any way, you can read that the whole way through and it doesn't damage the film in any way. And at no point do they say, oh, well, he's totally straight. Because it's clear that there's this thing between Ben-Hur or between Judah's sister and Masala.
Right.
Yeah.
But he sends them away like it's nothing. Yeah. And it's like, it's not the sister he was interested in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, no.
It was Judah Ben-Hur.
That was totally there in the beginning of the movie. Like, well, there is some connection here between these guys and some tension, like unresolved feelings that these two have not put out in the open.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why that death sequence where Judah walks in and you see him and he's looking at him with this just cold indifference, that's heartbreaking, man.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you've had this whole buildup. And had this been something that was done in a modern time where you could actually get away with saying it, there could have been something there. Or, I mean, if it had been done with a male and a female character, you would have done the same thing. That is the death of their relationship, whatever it was. That, I mean, that's just rough.
So why did this movie just become a huge success? Why did it win so many Academy Awards? Why did it just totally blow the box office?
Well, I mean, it's a good movie.
I
think it's a well made movie.
You know,
I think if you take your critique against the Christianity throwing down, besides the story kind of gets away from itself at the end, but that first 3 hours, solid movie.
Regardless, I mean, if we go back to the Forrest Gump story, Forrest Gump is a very long movie by itself. It's not 3 hours long, but it's 2.5, something like that.
But it's like the entirety of the 1950s, 1960s, and 70s.
Yeah. But if you follow the Ben-Hur story, there's not a whole lot you can take out of his adventures.
Sure.
Without the story having a big gaping spot going, what happened here?
Right.
I mean, they attempt to do it when we flash forward to them going to Rome.
Right.
And he meets Caesar.
And it's great.
And then we flash forward and it doesn't say 3 months later. He's just like, you have been in the arena 5 times and you've done great things. And so you know time has passed and these kinds of things, especially when the circus came about, what, twice a year, something like that.
Oh, I don't know.
So, you know, time has passed.
Sure. And it was great because, like, thinking back on it, it's like they did that when they're like, you have become a great charioteer. And it's like they blew all their budget on the last scene. They couldn't have a middle chariot race in which Ben-Hur wins because they couldn't possibly afford it.
Well, but I think if they did have a middle chariot race, it would negate or lessen the spectacle of the final chariot race.
I can see that.
And I also think that the chariot race, and this is, it's kind of like this way to the egress, or, oh, by the way, if you tell everybody that the egress is the exit, you're going to look like a fool.
Right.
What I think happened is a lot of people went to this movie, got to the chariot race 3 hours into it, and was like, I'm going to tell everybody how great the chariot race is, and not tell them how slow everything else is.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So they get suckered into going to this movie. I think the chariot race is the pivot point around this whole movie.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Everything else
because if you throw the chariot race in before the intermission, everyone just never comes back after the intermission's over.
Exactly.
That's probably exactly it. And I mean, the chariot race is incredibly influential. I mean, if you watch Grease, you can see.
Yep.
And by the way, that movie takes place before 1959. So those kids invented it and Ben-Hur stole it from them.
Yeah. Good.
No, you're good.
Yeah, I mean, the chariot race is what people remember from Ben-Hur. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, I guess, weirdly connected, in Chariots of Fire, all anybody ever remembers is
running on the beach.
Running on the beach towards each other. You know, like that. It's like that scene that makes the movie.
Right.
And everything around it. I knew about the chariot race in Ben-Hur. I had no idea what Ben-Hur was about.
Mm.
Like, at the beginning when it's like, Ben-Hur, a story of the Christ, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I thought this was a story about like a Roman guy.
Yeah. So, yeah. What can you take away from this, Zach? We said we were going to make this episode shorter than the movie, so
we're getting close.
Yeah, we got a while. What am I going to take away from this? I mean, there's something to say about spending a lot of money to make a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works really well, and this is certainly one of those.
Well,
cases.
So I wonder. You know, in this day and age, you were talking about tens of thousands of people involved in the circus the chariot race scene.
Yeah.
You know, when Lucas did it in Phantom Menace, they had miniature sets as well. But what they ended up doing was they built the stadium seats, but all the people were little popsicle sticks painted with the faces on there. And they had it all rigged up so that somebody on the edge could flip some levers up and down and the people could do the wave and all that kind of stuff. Instead of building a giant arena, we would digitally do it today.
Yeah.
And we can have stuff that is spectacle today on the screen, but
for a smaller budget,
they're working in our backyard.
Yeah.
Right? You and I could go out and shoot something in the backyard right now. Well, not right now.
Not right now. It's kind of dark.
We could go out into the backyard and shoot something right now, and with today's digital technology, we could be in a gladiator arena with tens of thousands of people around us, and we did it in our backyard, and we did it with a laptop computer.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's what I think. It's going to be interesting to see, because this movie is slated to be remade and released in 2016.
Right.
I didn't do the calculation on inflation for budgets. So this is like $15 million in $58.
Like $150
million. $150
million,
sure. Sure. Something that would be a reasonable budget, I guess, I would think. For the coming remake, because certainly it's not going to be 3 hours and 40 minutes long. It'll be about 2.5. I mean, maybe. I mean, I don't. What's the longest movie released?
How long is frickin' Hobbit and Lord of the Rings stuff? That stuff's bordering on 2.5 hours.
Oh, yeah, 2.5. Yeah.
I think King Kong was 3 hours.
Was it?
I think so.
So
if you tie Peter Jackson to it, it'll definitely hit the 3 hour mark.
Well, it's Mark Burnett and his wife, and I think the only other person tied to it right now is Morgan Freeman as the Sheik.
As the Sheik, okay.
And
reprising his role from Robin Hood.
Yes. And I believe a rumor was Gal Gadot as Esther.
Oh, okay.
So that'll be interesting to see how they play that, I think.
Oh, then she'll just save Ben-Hur from the chariot race. She'll just jump in there.
Yeah. Invisible jet.
Do it, yeah. She'll just do it all herself with a lasso.
Yeah. But what I'm really interested in with the Ben-Hur remake, after seeing this 59 version, which this movie apparently gets remade all the freaking time, because it was a silent film, and then it was
there was a
film,
series,
and now it's
too.
It was an animated movie.
Yeah.
That I found that.
Yep.
Almost watched it and just reviewed that instead because it's a lot shorter. But
Rankin Bass.
Yeah. What I think will be interesting about the remake of Ben-Hur is it's coming out at this time of a lot of these biblical narrative films. We saw Noah last year with Russell Crowe. Ridley Scott's getting in the game with Exodus coming out with Christian Bale this December. You know, they had the Bible thing on the History Channel. There's a lot of things.
What do you think that is?
Well, one, because it's a freaking money grab. Like, there is a... So this is why I think the Ben-Hur thing is interesting. Because when you venture into this territory, you get a lot of people, which I would classify them as a loud vocal minority, coming against what they perceive as the historical accuracy of these stories. We saw it a lot in Noah, which if you haven't actually seen Noah, you should, because it's Pie Man.
Aronofsky
doing a film that's visually, he does some really cool things with the storytelling. Yeah. I enjoyed it. A lot of people hated it because he had like these cool rock monster things in there.
Nice.
They have unicorns crying as the...
No,
they were too busy off playing, and that's why they didn't get
it. You guys see Fantasia 2000?
Yeah.
That's, like, one of my favorite parts.
Yeah.
Where, like, Donald Duck is, like, hurting all these guys, and there's, like, a dragon and a unicorn and a couple other weird monsters, like, laughing at him, like, getting into a boat.
Yep.
So I thought that was a good movie, but a lot of people were angry because it took liberties with their source material.
Right.
Most certainly Exodus Kings and Gods or Kings or whatever it's called, will most certainly take liberties with the
gods
source
and kings,
Gods and Kings. We'll most certainly take it. I mean, before we look at the trailer, the Coldplay's the song behind the whole thing anyways.
It's like a knight's tale for the Bible.
There you go.
So that will most certainly be cried foul by a lot of people. But I think with the Ben-Hur story, the way they go at it, if you're trying to get Christian money, which there's a lot of it, to be had, even if they hate it and they'll go watch it and they'll complain about it, that you get around this idea of needing to be specifically biblically accurate because you're telling this side story that wasn't really there with these tangential incidents of Jesus. So I'm interested just to see what they do with it, I guess, but mostly like, what's the reaction going to be from Christian people?
Right. You said they flipped their lid on Noah. And how well did the movie do?
I think it may have.
Made a crap ton?
I think it made a lot of money.
So Noah 2 is just around the corner?
They already made it. It's called Evan Almighty. now, you said that the people directing, like slated to direct, have already done some Bible stuff.
Yeah, they did the miniseries, The Bible.
The miniseries Bible on History Channel. Which
was really good. I mean,
yeah,
visually very, very good.
Yeah, scored by Hans Zimmerman.
Wow.
Which was weird because I was at church and they're like, they like showed a thing for it, and I was like, why do I get the sense that Jesus is Batman in this?
Nice.
And then I was like, oh, it's because Hans Zimmer scores everything.
Yeah.
Well, and Roma Downey, who is Mark Burnett's wife, was actually the brains behind Touched by an Angel.
Right. And she was in miniseries.
She was the angel.
She was an angel. Interesting. Let's see. Noah made
$362 million on a $100 million, $125 million budget. That's worldwide is what I'm looking at.
Oh, worldwide. Yeah, I'm looking at domestic.
In the U.S., it didn't do so well.
Twice over?
No.
It did, twice over. Which, considering how they market stuff today, it almost has to be $400 million in order to break even. So,
but there are some, like, really... I mean, if you want to get... And this is kind of stuff I enjoy talking about.
No, go ahead.
What... The church was going against the movie, which was a lot of it was he put these like rock monster creatures, which were like the fallen angels that came and they wanted to be with the people after they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden.
Sure.
Yeah. They don't call them that. They call them like these creatures things, but that's what people took them to be. But they're these really cool things that like band together to defend Noah's family so they can get on the ark because they know that God is going to try to destroy all the earth. And so there's this other band of people who are trying to kill Noah because they have the boat that's going to save them after everything.
Right.
And so they're all banding together. So they really hated those, which was a really cool, interesting part. But there's this other thing where Noah, they're actually on the ark and Noah sits down with his family and he's going to tell them the creation story. And you can watch it online. They have this clip of it, and it is visually one of the coolest thing ever. Spoilers, it is straight up evolution, the way they portray it.
Nice.
And no one ever cried foul, which I could understand because he like takes you through the evolution of the earth through like this evolving creature, and you're just like above it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really interesting.
Well, you know, the Pope... just a couple of weeks ago was like, hey man, evolution fits within.
Yeah. There's actually been, I think I was talking to some people, two popes, was John Paul ago.
Yeah.
They said he was like totally cool with it too.
Yeah.
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 It was a former Nazi pope that had a problem with it.
Yeah.
Everybody was in the Hitler Youth back in the day. I mean, it's true. He was.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
It's kind of not his fault. You were either in the Hitler Youth or you were being stomped.
Mm-hmm. So Noah's interesting.
What else did you take away from Ben-Hur?
I actually really liked the score of this movie. It actually won an award, and apparently it's the only award for like historical Roman or something that's ever won an Oscar.
Really?
I don't know. It was like a weird caveat. It's like, this is the only person that wore glasses that ever won an Oscar or something weird like that. But I enjoyed it. It actually put me to sleep twice. Because I watched it and I was tired. And really, this movie, as it, they released this on LP, because of course.
Yeah.
It was three LPs long, which I don't even think that's true, because this movie is 3 hours and 40 minutes long. It's probably 30% dialogue and 70% music of them like walking or traveling in boats and stuff.
Sure.
And chariots. Yep. But I really dug the score.
Cool.
Yeah.
Did Aubrey watch it with you?
She watched it at the beginning of with me and then fell asleep.
Okay.
And then, yeah, she watched little bits and pieces with me. Yeah. I have no idea if she liked it, because every time I think she likes it, then I ask her, and she's like, no, not really. But she didn't say she hated it.
I think it'd be interesting to see a modern religious person's take on this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be. Just to see how that aligns with...
Which religion are we talking?
Take any religion, but take I think the two big ones, let's take the Jewish and the Christian,
mm-hmm.
whatever denomination you want to throw in there.
Sure.
All of them.
General.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just see what their reaction to the movie is. I really think that people would have... I think you would get a very varied feedback on this.
Mm. Oh, I mean, yeah. I would...
In the portrayal of the characters and portrayal of the religion in the context of the time, I think you would just have a very different...
How are you leaning? You think it'd be like a positive, or you think it'd be negative based solely on the religious aspect of the film?
I think if you ask people to watch it from that religious aspect and, mm-hmm. and you identified them as, we want people who identify as religious in these categories.
Yeah.
I think that they would come in and see this film very, very differently.
Well, 55 years later, I think that there's first of all, different expectations of what it means to be religious.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Because someone who identifies as a modern Christian is going to be much, 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 much more liberal than the people who would have gone to the theater when this was in.
Oh, sure.
Was first run in the box office.
I will say that I was a little bit troubled by the religious aspects of it, but only in the general sense that I don't necessarily like to mix religion and pop culture, mostly because I find that it's very seldom done well in a way that's, unilaterally not offensive.
Right, right.
And this story's undertones are, very kind of a very 1950s kind of, conform and come around to the real way of thinking kind of vibe.
Yeah, exactly.
But Charlton Heston playing a Jew, that I can deal with. I'm kind of fine with that, really. I can deal with that. But when you look at his character arc, there's so much going on that if they never spoke of the character, if they never made such a big deal about the character being Jewish, you tell the same story, you have the same arc, does it have the same effect? Was part of the reason that this is such a powerful story that the character was such an outspoken and, strong leader amongst the Jewish community in Judea? I don't know.
Well, I think that's the core of the story.
Exactly. Or at least part of the core of the story. It's definitely something that is important to the way the story is told in this movie. And I think that could be definitely seen as something problematic, especially, six decades down the line. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I've spoken out before. I'm not a huge religious person.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes when it comes to religious films, I feel like they very much browbeat you
mm-hmm.
over the head to think that this way that the religion is being portrayed is the only way to think about the religion. And so to me, that is very disturbing on many, many levels.
Now, there's lots of ways to incorporate religion into a movie. But a lot of the big mainstream movies tend to have a very kind of, and by religion I do mean generally Christianity.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to have a very Christian positive attitude.
Right.
And that can very much feel preachy because they're like, see, here's all the reasons, here's all the good reasons why when you see Jesus, you should be like, oh, mm-hmm. he's so great. And for someone who's not very religious, it does feel like it's like, all right, I get it, cool, all right. Next mm-hmm. scene. It's like the next scene kind of does the same thing. It's like, all right, I got it. I got it.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I would probably feel that way regardless of whatever religious movie I was watching, just because of the way I look at
sure.
it. Just to put this in a different perspective, I've watched a lot of foreign films from a very specific country.
Mm-hmm.
And when you watch those films from the country and you know that they're funded by the country's
government. Yeah.
You watch it a little bit closer and you can see how this is all very pro this ideology. right. that they want you to see.
Well, actually,
but if you take it out, it's a very enjoyable movie.
Yeah.
But just like Ben-Hur, very enjoyable movie. But you look at it from that different prism and you're like, oh, I see what they're doing here. I see how the censors went in and did this, 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 and this.
I'll give you a great example from my point of view. I'm pretty liberal in my politics.
Right.
And sometimes I'll sit there watching a Michael Moore documentary and I'm like, just get on with it.
Yeah.
It's like, just like beats you over and over and over. And it's so heavy handed sometimes that I'm like, I feel like more people are walking out of this theater as Republicans now because this is like so over the top sometimes.
Yeah.
I think I know where you're coming from because this is really heavy handed in it. Especially looking at it from being raised in a Christian home, and looking at this film is like, even one of like Pontius Pilate's lines is like when they're in Rome, he said something about like washing his hands. I was like, you have got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because it's like religion is such a big thing in the world. Mm-hmm. Someone has to have figured out a way to, or maybe not. Maybe it's just like they put people into stereotypes so much that there has to be a way to make a movie and put religion in it and not to be like crazy, but it's just like, just treat it like anything else in the world.
Well, I was going to say, so Kirk Cameron, everybody remembers.
Where's this even going?
No, listen. So the same argument can be made about Rob Liefeld or whoever that people have a general dislike of.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk Cameron is very much extreme religion. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we were to say, let's pick a religion and who's the most extreme, Kirk Cameron would be the poster child of that, whatever we're talking about. Kirk Cameron makes a lot of religious-based films.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Kirk Cameron makes a crap ton of money off those religious-based films.
Yes.
Do you know why?
Yeah.
Because capitalism?
Yes, capitalism. Because what he does is he goes around to the religious groups and churches and says, hey, this is what my film's about.
Sure.
You need to support this because it's furthering our message.
Sure.
Tyler Perry is kind of the exact same way.
Oh, he did the same thing.
He does the exact same way. I didn't realize, I mean, everybody's seen the Madea films, but I didn't realize until probably 5 years after I left Atlanta that he owned a major movie studio in Atlanta. And you're like, the guy that dresses up as a woman's got all this money?
Sure.
Because he follows the same marketing structure.
Sure.
He takes the film to the communities and says, this is something that's supportive of our community.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You guys should go watch it and shop it around and ship it around and makes the money that way. I think for religious films, that's kind of how they have to do it, is they have to find their audience. Kevin Smith is another good example.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tusk failed at the box office at 3,000 theaters because they were marketing to a broad audience.
Mm-hmm.
If Kevin Smith went and did it like he did Red State, where he went around from town to town and he said, hey, my peoples, come and watch my movie, that movie would have been a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's identifying your audience and not realizing that you have to go out into a broad world and force it upon everyone. You need to go find that audience. You need to market directly to them to get the response that you're hoping to get.
Well, absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's why any movie opens in select theaters, right?
Sure.
There is a market for a Lars von Trier film, and it's not everyone.
Yeah.
Right. All right, anything else, Zach?
No, I just got to open my script so I can actually end the show. Because that's it for this episode of Zach on Film.
Let me ask you this, just so before we get out of here.
Yeah.
Oh, but
did anybody really hate this movie?
No, I
actually really enjoyed it. I thought the ending, full disclosure, iTunes rentals only last for 24 hours. I somehow gamed mine because I didn't turn my Apple TV off for a while to get like 6 hours more. Still didn't get to finish it. I watched the last 20 minutes through random clips on YouTube and AMC, but I did pretty much get the whole thing. But the ending was weird to me. But like the 3 hours before it, I really did enjoy, which surprised me.
Matthew?
I didn't hate it. There are certain movies that I watch where I'm like, afterwards, I feel like if I had the choice, I'd just take the time back. And this is one of those. I did not hate it. It was an enjoyable movie. It was not necessarily an experience that I would have chosen to have knowing going in what it was, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Nope.
If I knew what the movie was, I wouldn't have to see the movie.
There you go.
Okay. Okay, so now that's the end of Zach on Film. You can head to majorspoilers.com and find this podcast posting page and give any comments and start any discussions you want to about what we've discussed while discussing Ben-Hur or anything you thought of while watching the movie by yourself or in a previous watching of the film. While you're there, click the Amazon.com link. Holidays are coming up. Got to do a lot of shopping on there, most likely. If you click on that link, nothing's going to cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to help keep this massive entertainment company that's up on the rise going and not, you know, just making cool stuff for you every week. So, with that, that's the end of this episode of Zach on Film. Zach is scrolling through to find the next movie, which is Cool Hand Luke.
Cooks.
Cool Hand Luke, next time on Zach on Film.